Welcome to The Paleo View. I'm bestselling author and co-creator of realeverything.com, Stacy Toth. I focus on being healthy inside and out through real life, food, and talk.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times bestselling author and creator of thepaleomom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome back to The Paleo View. I'm so excited. I know that you might have listened to a show already this year, but Sarah, it's our first time in 2020 being back. I cannot thank you and our listeners enough for giving us a break over the holidays. Was it as restorative and wonderful for you as it was for me?
I took a real break. We actually went winter camping between Christmas and New Year's, where, you know, we were the only tent in the whole campground, but we were fine. We made it, we stayed warm. And so being able to like completely unplug, right? Phones don't work in these state parks. That's why I go there. I feel like we're getting back into routine. Kids are back at school and I just have so much more focus. Like I'm really noticing I really needed the brain break. That was, I've been working really hard this fall to, address how overextended I was in just about every aspect of my life. And that was starting to really hurt my own physical and mental health. And it was the mental health symptoms that were like the really scary big warning, better be proactive now, or this doesn't go anywhere good for me. And it just kind of feels like, I feel not that I'm, all the way recovered from how much I ran myself into the ground in the early part of the fall, but I'm starting to feel, joy. I love nerding out so much, Stacy. And it's really wonderful to get back into it and just be like, new information, and I can be all riled up about this new information, and then I can share it on a podcast, and then I can write a blog post about it, and then, it just makes me happy in my heart.
All right, before we nerd out too hard, I have some news and updates from my break as well, and I did share on social media over the break, so, I feel like I need to update our listeners as well from our last show. So I talked about a change that was coming in our family that we weren't quite ready to discuss. It's because I wanted to tell my family face-to-face over the holidays, but Matt and I are training to be foster parents, and we will finish our training at the end of January, and we hope to welcome our home to whomever might need it for maybe 3 months, maybe up to 6 months from now, depending on, what is needed when. And that is the reason that we are not moving to Florida. I know a lot of people were really curious, like, what's going on? Why did you change your mind? We decided that we were going to stay in Virginia where we have a good support system, and that means the foster system is by state. So we will perhaps be moving out of our home, but we will be staying in Virginia. And before you jump in, Sarah, I do want to add one more thing, which is that Matt officially started his first day as a mailman with the United States Postal Service yesterday. So we've had a lot of change going on in our family, which we knew was coming and we were working on. So 2019, as I said on the last episode, was kind of our year of reevaluation and change. And then this year is our year of like rainbow and gratitude and following our hearts and all of that stuff. And so I know it was veiled and cryptic and weird, and I said it was all good stuff. So there it is. It's out there.
Holy. I just feel like we need to talk about all of this stuff for an hour instead of our topic.
Nope. We've got a big topic to jump into. But like I said, I wanted to update our listeners.
Exciting. Yeah. Positive. Wait, I want Matt to be my mailman. No
way. He can't be.
I love my mailman, Mike.
So that's he's essentially like a substitute teacher mailman, if that makes sense.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, he trains to be a mailman like everybody else, but then he will be, you know, like the filling in for people that go on vacation or get sick or whatever it is. And he will not be in your city, and he will not be in our city either. I'm not going to say what city he's going to be in, but he will obviously in the Northern Virginia area, because it has to be local for us. And he's super excited. Anybody who knows my husband knows he doesn't really like people. He loves podcasts. He loves helping people. He just doesn't like social interaction with them. And the fresh air and sunlight of being outdoors the way that a postman will be very good for him health-wise, mental and physical. So we've talked a lot about why that makes sense here on the show. Hopefully all these puzzle pieces will come together for you as to why Matt would want to help people, but not necessarily talk a lot to them and all that stuff. So anyway, I'm excited. And of course, we'll be talking more about it as things progress. But I think the most important thing I do want to say, and we did a very in-depth blog post about why we chose to be foster parents and what we will and won't be talking about going forward. And honestly, the most important thing is the privacy and respect of the children who might come to our home. We will not be sharing anything about them, no photos, no nothing. And I think that our listeners can understand why that's important. And I appreciate everyone's respect of that privacy, because it's not ours to give.
Yeah. I think we can all understand the need for privacy, and I'm super excited for all of the, like, just, I really think really positive change that you're jumping like headfirst into. That's like, I'm super excited. So do you want to talk about this for an hour, or do you want to talk about
No. We have a topic that I actually requested. And I know you did a ton of research on. Mm-hmm. And I have some personal experience with intermittent fasting, which is what we're going to talk about today. And I come at it from the perspective of someone who doesn't have a gallbladder. So my experience is not necessarily the same as everybody's, because we've talked about how that doesn't work for me. But I know that, you know, it's hot right now, the way that keto is hot, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And we got some requests to talk about this topic. And then I know you and I have talked about it previously, but there's got to be updated science since what we've been doing this 10 years. So I thought it would be good to,
order of magnitude,
to jump back into it now at the New Year's. If this is something people are considering, we can guide them to what the science says.
Yeah, actually, I think, as I told you before we started recording, this was a very meaty subject for me to dive into the research and prepare for this podcast. And I actually ended up writing a new blog post as I was preparing. So we'll make sure that there's a link to the new blog post, because it'll have all the scientific citations and everything in the show notes. But I was actually... there's been so much research just in the last 2 years that answers a lot of questions that needed to be answered to really understand whether or not the hype around intermittent fasting is warranted. And I think it's kind of important to start this topic off with a little bit of like history. Like, how did this get to be a thing? And it really came from, there are some blue zones, which are little pockets, cultural pockets in the world where there's a higher percentage of centenarians, right? So a higher percentage of people who live to be over 100 with full health their entire lives. And there's been a lot of study of, you know, what are these people doing right? And it really boils down to all of the things that we talk about on this podcast. They eat whole food, nutrient-dense diets. They don't overeat. They all have, all of these cultures have a lot of movement built into their days. So, for example, the Okinawans don't have furniture. So even as people are aging, they're getting up and down off the floor 14 to 20 times a day, which is maintaining muscle mass, and it's, you know, changing lymphatic flow and all of the things that movement is really important for. They all have, they all tend to live in sync with the sun, so they're all getting enough sleep, and they all have really, really strong social connections. So there's some kind of little effect of everything that they're doing that is leading to these little pockets of populations, better health, and intermittent fasting came from rodent studies. And it, you know, this was sort of done in the 90s and early 2000s, and it was really exciting. So rodents on intermittent fasting, they either lose body fat or total body weight. And this even seen on when they're fed high fat diets. They have improved insulin sensitivity, reduced fasting glucose and insulin. Their blood pressure normalizes, their lipid profiles normalize, and they have lower levels of inflammation and oxidative stress. And those are all like great things. And so that combined with, I think, the non-quality controlled aspect of the internet, where an anecdote can take on more weight than it ever would in the context of the scientific community, right? So somebody says, I intermittent fasted, I lost 300 pounds, look at my abs, everyone should do this, right? And so that type of magnification, along with this little bit of science that in rodents is really compelling, has allowed intermittent fasting to become a pretty popular, I don't know if I want to call it a diet itself, like dietary strategy. And what's interesting is research, I mean, is really only catching up over the last decade. There's been only about a dozen human studies ever, like well-controlled, ever done in intermittent fasting. And the first few studies, you know, as soon as they started using a randomized crossover design, so that's where you take the same group of people, you randomly assign them into the intermittent fasting group and a control group, and then they switch. And that way you can tell, right, is it because this came first and this came second or not? And you can really dial in on the, like, what the effect is. As soon as studies were done that way, it started to show that intermittent fasting, it does, you know, one of the goals here is that by restricting your feeding window, or you can do what's called alternate day fasting, which is a form of intermittent fasting. There's two main forms. Alternate day fasting, you eat one day, you don't eat the next day, and intermittent fasting, where you have a shorter window of time in which you have to get in all your calories. It's also called a time-restricted feeding window. So the time-restricted feeding window is definitely the most popular. If you're just looking up intermittent fasting on the internet, that's what you'll see most sort of influencers promoting, and they'll just say, like, just don't eat till noon, right? They'll say skip breakfast, and like stick a pin in that, because that's where the science is really problematic for supporting intermittent fasting. But what's interesting is that the initial studies that did this show, you know, on average, even if you overeat on one day, if you don't eat the next day, your average calories over those 2 days is going to be lower. And most people find this harder than caloric restriction. At least that's what's reported in the couple of studies that have compared some form of intermittent fasting against straight caloric restriction. And people tend to lose less weight with intermittent fasting than caloric restriction, at least with the eating in the evening kind of intermittent fasting. However, these days, diet culture is all about extremes. And there is a group of people who, the more extreme the diet is, the easier it is to do. It almost feels easier to do because it's more extreme and harder. Like it's more of a break from the normal routine. It's sort of like the equivalent of quitting smoking by going cold turkey, or it's as close to that as you can get with diet, because if you stop food cold turkey, bad things happen, like starving to death. So the studies have really shown that, yes, you can lose weight, but no better or worse than any other weight loss diet. And that all of the benefits, there are benefits to metabolic parameters. So really that's glucose regulation and insulin sensitivity, and benefits to cardiovascular disease risk factors, which is lipid profiles, so cholesterol, triglycerides, and blood pressure, that all of those benefits can be completely attributed to the fact that those people lost weight. And it's basically all of those things tend to improve when we're losing weight, right? Because they're directly, those systems are like, that is the system that is regulating our insulin sensitivity and our cardiovascular risk factors. So that was sort of the state of the research up until a couple of years ago. And then there was a really important study done in 2017, which we talked about recently on our podcast about eating breakfasts, where they looked at intermittent fasting with a time-restricted window, feeding window, and they looked at what's called an early time-restricted feeding window. So those people skipped dinner. So they ate for, I think it was like 6 hours. So they ate from like 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. versus shifting that window. So those people were skipping breakfast. So they were basically eating lunch and dinner. And they compared that to 3 meals a day with everything controlled. Caloric intake was controlled. Macros were controlled. Supervised feeding, right? All of the things that you look for really, really well-designed clinical trial. And what was fascinating about this study was that they showed that there was a very small increase in energy expenditure in both of the fasting groups. They showed that there was a slight increase in fat oxidation, which would be beneficial for weight loss in the breakfast skipping group. But they showed that skipping breakfast came at the cost of increased inflammation. This is in addition to a bunch of other studies that have looked at breakfast skipping as a lifestyle habit that is a very good way of sort of studying intermittent fasting, because that's what it is. It's just called I never bother to eat breakfast. And as we talked about in our podcast about breakfast being the most important meal of the day, there's a bunch of studies showing that regularly skipping breakfast increases cholesterol, increases insulin resistance, like 54% increase in insulin resistance, which is a huge effect. And that there's even been some large meta-analyses just published in the last few months that have shown that if you regularly skip breakfast, you're at much higher risk of developing diabetes, type 2 diabetes specifically, and at much higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease. And it's...
Can I ask a question before we moved on to cardiovascular and some of the, other than skipping breakfast, the dinner stuff I think is interesting. But before we do that, I think there's such a disconnect, because everything that I've known or heard about from intermittent fasting and what we you talked about at the top of the show, the buzz of IF being improving insulin sensitivity seems incongruous to the result of skipping breakfast and having this intermittent fast of not doing it in the morning and that result. Right. I wonder, like, I know when I originally heard about it, it was on a paleo podcast years and years ago, and they talked about kind of cellular regeneration and turnover. And then the other thing of benefit mm-hmm. was insulin, and therefore it was like recommended for mm-hmm. lifters to use this because you could metabolize at the right windows of time, blah, 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 right? I'm not going to get into all of that and make this overly complicated. But I guess I'm just being the voice of what? Like, how could the selling feature of intermittent fasting be?
Right.
Yeah.
The human studies show the opposite of the rodent studies. So here's some interesting things that have come out of the rodent studies. So one of the things that's come out of it is that it's really important for the feeding window to be aligned with circadian rhythms. And so that was discovered a number of years ago, that if you make the feeding window, so rodents are naturally nocturnal. They would naturally eat at night. And if you make their feeding window during the day, any benefit to intermittent fasting goes away. And if you make their feeding window at night, they can actually have, for example, they can eat a high-fat Western-style diet and not develop obesity or diabetes. And it really has to do with synchronicity between the feeding window and the light-dark cycle. Like when that animal would normally be hormonally aligned with eating. So that's one of the really interesting things that came out of the animal studies that is going to feed into where intermittent fasting may be beneficial. One of the things that you mentioned was autophagy, and I really want to make sure that we emphasize that from this standpoint. So one of the things that intermittent fasting does in rodents is stimulate autophagy. It's like a spring cleanup of your cells. So cells basically go, I don't have energy. Oh, you know what? I got all of these useless broken down organelles lying around. I'm going to cannibalize those and use those for energy. And then I'm going to make new organelles. And what it does is it basically is like the spring cleanup in cells is sort of how it's like traditionally referred to. And it makes the cell more efficient. It has these other side benefits like underlying viral infections that might have gone unnoticed by the cell can be discovered this way and can be actually, those viruses can be destroyed through autophagy. There's really great, like legit great benefits to autophagy. Autophagy is also stimulated by exercise and while we sleep. So getting enough sleep and living an active lifestyle stimulates autophagy. I think there's this idea that the only way to get autophagy is with like keto and intermittent fasting. And you sort of hear this term being like thrown around only in relation to these, I think we'll call them fad diet approaches. And it's very unclear how much autophagy is actually being stimulated in humans. I found one study that showed with early time-restricted feeding, which means skipping dinner instead of skipping breakfast, that there is a little bit of autophagy increase as measured through genetic expression. But the magnitude of effect in humans seems to be fairly different than the magnitude of effect in animals. And this is where I think, you know, people who listen to our podcast regularly know that I put a lot of value into mechanistic rodent studies. I see those as being really, really important data to pay attention to. So a mechanistic rodent study is where you're using that animal model to understand the mechanisms behind an effect that co-occurs in humans. It's already been established to co-occur in humans. So this thing happens in humans and in rodents. We're going to use the rodent model to understand how it's happening, why it's happening. Intervention studies are a different thing. An intervention study is where you make a bunch of rodents sick and give them a drug and then measure how much better they get. And it is much harder to draw a straight line between an intervention study in rodents and an intervention study in humans. So where the intermittent fasting studies in rodents are really interesting is where they show that it stimulates autophagy. There's been some really interesting studies showing that there's a gut microbiome piece to this. And our microbiomes actually have a circadian rhythm. So they're species that actually cycle throughout the day. And it's sort of like after feeding, they go up and then between feeding, they go down. And there's other ones that do the opposite. So after feeding, they go down and between feeding, right? An overnight fast, for example, they go up. And that's a normal cycle in our gut microbiomes. And when you feed rodents, all of these microbiome studies with intermittent fasting have been done in rodents so far. When you feed rodents a high-fat diet, they lose the cyclic nature of most of those species in their gut microbiomes. And then when you give them that same high-fat diet that makes them lose the circadian rhythm of their microbiomes, but you put them on intermittent fasting schedules, so they're only eating at night, which is when they're normally eat, then a lot of that cyclic nature of their microbiomes is restored. So there's some really interesting mechanisms revealed showing that intermittent fasting could potentially have cardiometabolic benefits above and beyond just like healthy food choices. However, the magnitude of effect is the thing that you can't draw the straight line. So you can't say just because it's a big effect in rodents, it's going to be a big effect in humans. And there's this piece of it, of the circadian rhythm, which has just been ignored until the last 2 years in the science, and certainly ignored by proponents of intermittent fasting. Because what this 2017 paper did, comparing breakfast skipping to dinner skipping, was it revealed that these negative effects of breakfast skipping don't apply to dinner skipping. So breakfast skipping was created higher insulin resistance for lunch, like later. So skipping breakfast meant you were more insulin resistant by the time you actually ate, and it was inflammatory. And there's other papers showing that it also creates problematic lipid profiles, right? Increasing cardiovascular disease risk as well. But dinner skipping didn't have that negative trade-off for the very, very small increase in energy expenditure. And so there's actually been two clinical trials done since that one that have also looked at this idea of intermittent fasting, but where you eat breakfast. So you get out of bed and you eat breakfast. You basically get all of your food into a 6 or 8 hour feeding window, but starting first thing in the morning. So instead of getting up and just having your, you know, black coffee, or if you, you know, buttered coffee, is, it's a very weak argument that that wouldn't break a fast. And instead of like pushing and pushing until lunchtime and then starting your feeding window, shifting your feeding window early. And that's where the human studies are actually really interesting, because instead of showing any benefit is just due to weight loss, so you might as well, you know, do a caloric, you know, find a energy deficit that is easier to maintain over the long term for sustainable, healthy weight loss. Instead of showing that as the one and only result, they've actually have shown some cardiometabolic benefits above and beyond any particular change in diet or weight loss. So a really great study that was actually, there were two papers published out of it, showed what they actually did was they controlled everything in order to have no weight loss occur. So they controlled caloric intake, they controlled macros, it was supervised feeding, it was a 5 week long study, and they compared early time restricted feeding, so skipping dinner, to a 12 hour feeding window, which is a little bit closer to normal. I think a lot of people actually gravitate towards more like a 14 hour feeding window. So a lot of people will eat after dinner before they go to bed. But this was, you know, as controlled as it could possibly be. And they showed that there was an improvement to insulin levels. They did a glucose challenge test afterwards and showed that the people who had been following the early time-restricted feeding had higher levels of insulin sensitivity. Their beta cells in their pancreas were healthier. They had reduced blood pressure. They had reduced levels of oxidative stress. And they also really interestingly measured leptin and ghrelin, which are hormones that regulate hunger, and found that both were lower, which corresponded to decreased appetite. So they actually, those authors of that study actually drew the conclusion that the benefits of this early time-restricted feeding, where you're doing intermittent fasting, but you're eating breakfast pretty soon after getting up in the morning, that has some independent cardiometabolic benefits, but that the major benefits actually come from that appetite regulation, because they just found that people got full easier. They weren't starving, which was really interesting, because I think it's also a much less intuitive eating pattern. I think when people say, oh yeah, just intermittent fast and you already don't want to eat breakfast, which is a sign of unregulated chronic stress. It's like this easy excuse to like not eat breakfast. Meanwhile, as we talked about in a previous podcast, eating breakfast actually improves insulin sensitivity, improves cardiovascular disease risk factors. And it's a really interesting, well, like, look, here's where we can start to take that rodent data and apply it to humans. We were just doing it wrong at first. We need to sync with our circadian rhythms, and to do that in humans, we need to be eating earlier in the day, not late into the evening, because we're diurnal, not nocturnal. So this 2019 study, it was just published a couple months ago, did, you know, same sort of crossover design, randomized, you know, super controlled. And interestingly, this study conflicted with the 2018 one and showed no particular benefit to energy expenditure, even though there have been a couple of studies. So that's still something that is, there's not enough data to be super conclusive on. There may be a small improvement to energy expenditure, and it might just be that the effect was too small to tease out statistical significance in this particular trial. But they did, this is the study that looked at an autophagy gene, they looked at an aging gene, they looked at brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is really important for central nervous system health, they looked at mTOR, and overall, they showed metabolic benefit of this early time-restricted feeding. Here's a huge caveat from this study, is that they also showed that this feeding pattern elevated morning cortisol and lowered evening cortisol, which may or may not be desirable depending on what your cortisol is doing now. So it's very much a, you know, but there's been a lot of talk for a long time that intermittent fasting is not appropriate for people with unmanaged chronic stress. And this is the data that would support that statement. So that's a really interesting extra find. And there's not many other studies, no other studies that I know of in humans that have actually measured cortisol in the morning and evening on a kind of intermittent fast. So so that's a really interesting caveat. But there is now like these three recent studies that were very well controlled, very well designed, you know, crossover study design that show that intermittent fasting with an early feeding window may have some benefits above and beyond, you know, a healthy diet. And that supports what we found in rodents. So there is this, okay, there's some interesting data here showing that intermittent fasting may be beneficial in humans provided your feeding window is early. But I think it's really important to emphasize what the magnitude of effect is, because that is what puts the effort that goes into intermittent fasting in context with all of the other healthy choices that we know to be making. So, for example, that 2018 5-week-long study showed fasting insulin decreased by 14.5%. It was statistically significant. The p-value was 0.05. And they... the HOMA index, which is like an overall measure of insulin sensitivity, though, it has statistical trend towards a decrease, but it was not actually statistically significant. So it's a small effect. And to put that into like, what does 14.5% reduced fasting insulin mean? We've talked about the importance of lifestyle on insulin sensitivity on the show before. I have an entire blog post just about how lifestyle impacts insulin, because we get very fixated on dietary strategies for insulin regulation, and actually our insulin is more sensitive to lifestyle than it is to diet. And there's studies showing that not getting enough sleep on, say, weeknights, say get 5 or 6 hours sleep Monday through Friday, will decrease insulin sensitivity by between 15 and 30%. There was even one study showing that just one night of partial sleep caused a 25% decrease in insulin sensitivity. So 5 weeks of this early time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting, had about half of the effect of just getting enough sleep. And so I think that's a really important, it's important to understand the magnitude of effect given the amount of effort intermittent fasting is for most people. It's not, especially skipping dinner versus skipping breakfast, is not a natural pattern that aligns with our societal structure for most people. In that 2017 paper that showed that skipping dinner created a slight increase in energy expenditure, and that was the, remember, that's not data that's been seen in every single study, they showed that those people burned about 91 extra calories throughout the entire 24-hour period. So 91 extra calories is about what you could burn with about just under 14 minutes of walking. So I would argue that intermittent fasting is only something to play with once you've done the work of the things like making sure you get enough sleep and sleep on a consistent schedule, that you're living an active lifestyle, that you're managing stress, because those things don't just improve cardiovascular disease risk factors or insulin sensitivity, right? They're improving mental health, neurotransmitter regulation, immune system function. They're all inputs into the gut microbiome and gut health. Like, we know that there's really diverse benefits of dialing in lifestyle. So when you start to look at these human studies and the magnitude of effect of intermittent fasting, it starts to become something that is certainly not compelling as a first-line strategy. There's some interesting data with that early time-restricted feeding window. You know, I would support anyone in my life who wanted to experiment with that if they're getting enough sleep and they're active and they've managed stress and they're eating a nutrient-dense, healthy diet and they've done that work first.
I think that makes a lot of sense with my logical thoughts on it, right? If we set aside the science, to me, I think if we look back at history and human development, we wouldn't have had exact meals at exact times throughout history, but we also wouldn't have been like regularly not avoiding or avoiding a certain meal at a certain time. So I think in natural fluctuations of appetite or busyness or, you know, whatever the case may be, people might not have a meal. And I think like the whole idea of it being dinner makes a lot of sense to me as well, because I think you're less likely to overeat breakfast than dinner / dessert. Do you know what I feel like that's,
yeah.
So I know a lot of people who find benefits from, as you discussed, autophagy or cellular regeneration or muscle building, like all of that being lumped into one, with timing it, understanding the full biology of their body, that really do have those things dialed in, sleep, nutrition, fitness, and they're using it to maximize muscle building and performance. And I think that's entirely different than looking at someone who has a high amount of inflammation and difficult digestion and is seeking a way to resolve that and might be introducing something that could potentially be more harm than help. And I think this idea, as complex as all of these studies and everything is, to me, is pretty simple and easy for me to understand from the perspective of, if you have those things, you need to be focused on fixing those things, right? Like, we know that there are certain things that we can do to reduce inflammation. We've talked about that so many times in the show. And, you know, I'd point you to a lot of them: nutrient density, removing inflammatory foods, getting sleep, getting sunlight, getting gentle movement. Those are the things that we know are great for that. And we don't jump into immediately skipping a meal, because while that might have tangential benefits to some of the things like we've talked about, the primary benefit of that is not reducing inflammation, right? Like, in none of these things, even the proponents of intermittent fasting, is the number one thing in their list suggesting that it's going to reduce your inflammation. So I think you know, considering that inflammation is a stressor, what can we do to reduce the stress in us? Overeating is certainly a potential stressor. So if you find yourself feeling like two nights a week, you're just not that hungry. I mean, I know for me personally, if I have a large lunch later in the day when the rest of the family is eating dinner, I might not. I might only have the salad that they're serving, or I might just be like, oh, I'm not hungry right now, and we'll see what happens later. You know, and I feel like if you're in tune with your body, that makes sense. And that's also the only way that it could potentially work for me, because of my gallbladder when I tried to intermittent fast with low carb paleo almost 10 years now, the result was disastrous in terms of digestion, because then trying to eat a meal not just after sleep, but then also an additional like 4 to 6 hours I was trying to fast in the mornings, it, no matter what I ate in the morning, it was not being digested well. So I think it's, you know, in addition to the things that you were talking about, like dialing in sleep and nutrient density and exercise, I would add to that really paying attention to your digestion, because I would argue that there are people who are ignoring the digestive signs in lieu of wanting something to work, or telling themselves like, well, I'm losing weight and therefore it's fine. And I know that because that was me. And so I would just suggest to anybody who is either thinking about this to prioritize, you know, documenting how you feel and how you're digesting the food, like have a little food journal as to, you know, when you ate what. Don't get too detailed and overwhelmed if you have disordered eating, for example. Like for me, journaling food can sometimes be a trigger, because then I feel like I need to fake it, or you know what I mean? Like whatever. But I say that for the point of being able to track your digestion and paying attention to that, so that you know the result of what you're doing, because you might not feel a lack of nutrient absorption in that moment, but long term, like what happened to me, you know, 6 months, a year, 18 months later, your hair's falling out, your thyroid's going crazy, you know, you're trying to figure out what went wrong. And what went wrong was, not only were you not eating during that period and putting your body into a starving cycle, but then on top of that, it wasn't absorbing what you were giving it. And then you have a whole bunch of other health problems that you have to tackle. And there are better ways, in my opinion, to lose weight if that's what you're trying to tackle, and you have digestive and inflammation factors. And I think, like, if you don't have those and you are focused on, you know, building muscle and really dialing it in and getting as healthy as you can be, and you've got everything else handled, like, I can see how this could be something to play with, to see how it makes you feel and how, you know, your body responds to it, and do the testing. It's easy to test your blood glucose and stuff now. Like, you can test that yourself. Yeah. But if you don't have those other things dialed in, I feel like this just introduces more problems than fixes, from my personal experience.
I mean, from the science, 100% agree. Not to be like super self-promoting, but I'm going to promote one of my own products on the podcast right now. I know it's pretty crazy. I have an online course that is available all the time. It's not like the AIP lecture series where it's session only and you can only, you know, sign up. I mean, for 2020, I'm just doing one session this year. But I have a course that is called the Healthy Weight Loss Course, and it is a few hours of video. And I go through a lot of the research on weight loss versus weight loss maintenance, because those are two very different things. And so the idea is that you want to lose weight in a way that is going to maintain your basal metabolic rate and not completely, you know, make your hunger hormones go completely bonkers, so that it is easy to maintain. Because one of the things with weight loss that becomes so challenging, especially with very extreme dietary approaches, is a lot of these extreme diets lower your basal metabolic rate. So you need to achieve a greater and greater caloric deficit in order to continue losing weight, while your hunger hormones, basically your ghrelin goes through the roof, so your appetite increases. And it's basically a recipe for failure. And so one of the things I've done in this online course, which we can, again, put a link in the show notes for people to go check out and see if it would be a good resource for them, is go through that research and all of the research on how to lose weight in such a way that maintains basal metabolic rate and helps to regulate hormones, and so that it's not just sustainable but maintainable on the other side. And the idea is to, you know, get healthier while losing weight rather than lose weight at the expense of things like insulin sensitivity and cardiovascular disease risk factors. And so I think that, you know, given that, right, there's two main reasons that people gravitate towards intermittent fasting. There's the performance piece, which there's not very much science looking at that, but the little bit that has been done has shown that there is some anabolic effects of intermittent fasting in athletes. It's kind of it's a whole sort of different question. And then there's these studies that we've talked about where they're trying to evaluate the effect on metabolism, insulin, cardiovascular disease risk factors, because it's in the context of people who are using intermittent fasting as a weight loss strategy. And that, I think, is far more common. So if you fall into that latter category and you have been either considering intermittent fasting as a weight loss strategy, maybe for a 2020 diet resolution, or you've done it in the past and you're kind of at that, you know, I've done all these different things and now I'm broken, right? We talked about yo-yo dieting on the podcast on a previous episode that we can also link to in the show notes. If you fall into those categories, I think that my healthy weight loss course will have a lot of really valuable information for you.
Awesome. I personally think getting some sleep and taking a probiotic to help my gut health are like just as powerful when it comes to controlling the hormones that are associated with appetite and all of that kind of stuff that we talked about. So just from personal experience, just get some sleep and take a probiotic. Everything will be fine. It's not actually, I'm not a doctor. That's not going to solve your problems.
It may help though.
Yeah. I can tell you from personal experience, it makes a difference. And for autophagy, we've talked about red light therapy as well. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah. Again, getting enough sleep and moving your body some way stimulates autophagy. You don't need to do these extreme weirdo diets in order to get the benefits of autophagy.
Sarah, thank you so much for all of the science on this topic. I know it's going to be a hot one. And I just want to reiterate to everyone that what really benefits you and your body is going to be different than what benefits somebody else. And to think about what it is you're trying to achieve and making sure that you're listening to your body really intentionally and thoroughly as you go about trying to improve that. It looks different for everybody, but the science is pretty conclusive on a couple of things. I was actually joking with Matt the other day that our podcast should be called Just Eat Some Vegetables. And that was that was a joke on the word should before I hear from people that I said it. But I feel like, you know, we talk a lot about the things that we know to be good for you on this show. And it's not a surprise to me that you could get equal to or better than results from focusing on sleep and activity and all the things that we recommend here on this show. And I think universally you hear health practitioners and gurus advise on those things being good for you. Shocking. So hopefully this was helpful from that perspective. And we wish all of you embarking upon whatever healthy habits you're trying to do this new year success. And just remember that taking small steps towards health in sustainable, long-term, achievable ways is the way to help yourself. And then, you know, jumping in, doing 50 things all at once and expecting the world to be completely different the next day is often a way to set yourself up for failure instead of success, which we don't want for you. We want you to be healthy and happy long-term. So thank you, Sarah, for helping do the research so that people can make informed decisions on living their best life.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.